Good afternoon, everyone. I would like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today is February 9th, and we will start by calling the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Chair Liebling.
Present.
Vice Chair Hewitt.
Present.
Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Backer.
Backer present.
Representative Bonner.
Bonner present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Bolden present.
Representative Damoth.
Damoth present.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Keel.
Present.
Representative Morrison. Representative Munson.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Ryer.
Present.
Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present. The next order of business is approval of the minutes of February 8th, which was yesterday. These were sent out to members and posted. Would anyone like to make a motion to approve the minutes? Don't all speak at once. Representative Hewitt. Would you move the minutes again for us, please? You're the official minute mover, it seems.
I was, and I still am. I was trying to give someone else a chance. So, yes, I so move.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt moves approval of the minutes of February 8th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The ayes have it, and the minutes are approved. Thank you, members. So here today we have our first bill of the session. And so we have Representative Schultz is here with House File 2914, the first engrossment. So Representative Schultz is going to move that House File 2914, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. So with that, Representative Schultz, welcome and go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. That is my motion. So members, House File 2914 was heard in the Human Services, Finance and Policy Committee. And basically, it's a extension of some of the executive order waivers for the agencies DHS and MDH. And I'm just going to quickly give you an overview of some of the waivers, and then I have an amendment, the A3-1 amendment. But the waivers are as follows. It allows oral or written signatures by applicants for public assistance programs. It allows oral or written permission from public assistance program participants for DHS to contact third parties to verify reported information. It allows video conferencing for monthly foster care visits if there's a public health emergency and there's a confirmed or suspected case of COVID. That is going to be the amendment that clarifies that language. Another waiver provides mandatory direct contact supervision requirements. It waives those requirements to allow individuals to work while they're waiting for their background studies to be completed. Another waiver, CV 53, allows two-way interactive telecommunications for oversight of personal care assistants. CV 89 allows program participants to give oral, written, or expressed approval of documents related to long-term services and supports that typically require in-person signatures. And we're going to skip the CCAP and child care provisions because those are going to be covered in Representative Pinto's committee tomorrow, I believe. And then there's a provision for establishing a temporary emergency staffing pool for congregate settings experiencing staffing crises. So these contracts, they could be sign-on bonuses, retention bonuses, payment for hours on call. It's a pretty exhaustive list of the facilities that can apply for these dollars for emergency staffing pools. So that is the bill, and maybe we can move the amendment.
Sure, Representative Schultz. So Representative Schultz, you have the A3-1. Would you like to move that?
I would like to move that A3-1 amendment.
Okay, and then if you would just describe again.
So this amendment I worked on with Representative Robbins, and it provides more guidelines around when agencies, local public health agencies, caseworkers can use these video conferencing for monthly foster care visits. If we're in a state of emergency and there's a suspected or confirmed COVID case in that household.
Okay, is there any discussion to the A3-1? No questions? Okay, seeing none then, all those in favor of adoption of the author's amendment, the A3-1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Schultz. And really at the beginning, I should have explained just a bit more about the process. I think members know what we're doing, but perhaps the public doesn't. So what we're doing here is assembling one bill that is has to do with some the agencies, the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health during the COVID emergency. There are certain things that happen that are really difficult to carry out that they are requesting to have some flexibility on, to have some waivers from what otherwise would be the rules. And so that's what we're doing here is putting some of those in a statute and or trying to anyway. So they started in the in Representative Schultz's Human Services Committee, where Department of Human Services presented and discussed more of those. And then it's coming to this committee mainly so that we can do the health department piece of this. And then another piece as well that I will discuss. So we're really assembling one bill that's all health and human services, but going to the relevant committees and going through the committee structure. We're sending it to Ways and Means. So I'm going to next present an amendment to the bill, which is mostly the health department piece of it. But I do want to be really clear with members, this is still a work in progress. So there are parts of this bill that will still get worked on. And this is how things happen often. We're moving it along to Ways and Means, but we are not saying that it's perfect. And so we very much welcome the input from members and the public as this goes through. And please contact us. And it's probably going to pause for a little bit at Ways and Means to get some additional tweaks done to it. So anyway, with that, Representative Schultz, did you want to have anything more to say about your piece of the bill?
I do not. Though we are still working with counties on the language for the foster care, child care visits. So we also might have a tweak there in Ways and Means, but I'll work with representatives and the counties on that language.
Okay, thank you very much. And I think we also have someone here who wanted to testify from MAXA, and I believe that what she wanted to testify to was that piece of the bill that's before I offer the next amendment. So maybe we should take her testimony now. Ms. Hannon, do you want to, there you are. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Stacey Hennen. I'm the Western Prairie Human Services Director, which serves Grant and Pope Counties, and I'm also the Traverse County Social Services Director. I'm here today representing MAGSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. As you're all aware, the pandemic has had significant impacts to all of us, but perhaps none have been hit harder than our state's already vulnerable populations. Counties have continued to work diligently to respond to the demands and shifting pandemic climate to ensure that service delays and interruptions are minimized during this difficult time. While monthly in-person face-to-face visits is critical to ensuring the safety and well-being of children, the pandemic has taught us that there are conditions where flexibilities can be safe and appropriate, and there's a need for it to be extended for children who are in placement. Counties agree that video or teleconferencing is not an appropriate option when there are concerns for child safety and or imminent risk. We seek permission to allow caseworkers to conduct required monthly face-to-face visits for children in placement via video or teleconferencing when there is a federal state emergency declaration and when suspected COVID-19 exposure threatens the safety and health of the child's residents or caseworkers. We appreciate the work to address and include the language that is responsive to the needs of the people we serve during this time. Counties feel strongly that the provisions should protect both the children and families we serve and our caseworkers. We support the inclusion of language in House File 2914 that allows for a virtual teleconference visit. But I want to speak directly to some of the caseworker pieces to this because the amendment as it stands really addresses the children and their families. So I'll give you some examples of issues that we've dealt with in the last couple of months. So we currently have three children placed 3 hours away. The case is less than 3 months away from an adoption, and the children have been stable in that home for several months. The family had an exposure and was needing to quarantine and test and requested that we do the visit remotely. We've been in the home many times. We visited with the children alone many times. The case is on track for adoption. It wouldn't put the children at risk to do a video conference call. For us, the reality is that we've also had 20% of our workforce out for several weeks running, just 20%, even differently each week, we've had 20%. So while we certainly can send another caseworker in person, if it's their caseworker who's quarantined or who's telecommuting and working from home, it's a much higher quality visit for them to spend that time visiting with them than for someone that they don't know or someone that they're not familiar with to drive up there just to lay eyes on them and see them and physically walk through a house that, you know, we know to be safe, or we have no reason to believe isn't safe, and we've been in several times before. So I think that's one of the reasons that we'd like you to consider including the caseworker as well as the family in terms of if there's a need for the health and safety of them as well. You know, we thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer questions, and we look forward to working with members to address any concerns. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hennen. Are there any questions from members for Ms. Hennen or any further discussion on this issue? Okay. I'm not seeing any. And as I stated before, Ms. Hennen, this is going to continue to be worked on. So thank you. Okay. So the next amendment is mine, and that is the A2-1. So I'm going to move the A2-1. And this contains a couple of pieces. The first piece is the Department of Health waivers. And then there's language in section 6 that pertains to temporary practice by healthcare professionals from other states and territories. So first I'm gonna invite the Department of Health to talk about their part of this amendment. So let's see, it looks like Ms. Rydrick is the person for us today on that, or let's see, is that correct? Okay, welcome, Ms. Rydrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you for having us here today to speak to this bill, which, as you noted, addresses the reinstatement of a narrow set of waivers that had previously been in place for the department under the public health emergency. And I will walk through this fairly briefly. And as you noted, Madam Chair, we also consider it to be a bit of a work in progress, especially as we're starting to testify more about this language in both bodies. We're hearing more from stakeholders about it, and it's certainly possible that it will continue to change as it moves through that process. So just briefly, the bill would give time-limited authority to MDH to waive limits on the addition of hospital and nurse nursing home beds in response to temporary surges in demand. And for the funeral industry, it makes modifications to storage provisions for decedents and the ability to use unlicensed staff for the mortuary and funeral industry. This is a different approach to waivers than what was in place during the emergency. So with the previous executive orders, the department had fairly broad authority to waive a number of requirements across a pretty broad range of statutes, not just for nursing homes and hospitals and the mortuary science or mortuary and funeral industry, but for other programs that we operate as well and other providers that we regulate. This is a much more tailored and time-limited approach, and it's based on what we've learned since that time about where some of the continuing challenges are for our regulated providers and for us when we get requests for a deviation or a variance from requirements that are in statute. And it really is tailored at short-term surges in demand when our statutes aren't nimble enough to allow providers to make changes. In terms of beds, it provides support to hospitals and nursing homes who have physical space that would allow for the addition of beds and who have staff for those beds, but they can't, under current law, flex their capacity upward due to the moratorium language that we have. Any waivers that are granted under this authority would expire no later than June 30th of 2022. And it is, as you'll see in the language, it is really about temporary increases, not for long-term changes to bed capacity and not for new hospital construction. Really briefly, for hospitals, it would allow temporary modification of licensed beds. As the members of the committee know, Minnesota has a hospital construction moratorium in place right now that restricts any increase in the amount of hospital bed capacity statewide. For a hospital to increase its bed capacity, they have to be added via an amendment. There has to be language written into the statute to give them the ability to add beds for a specific construction project, and they have to go through a public interest review and be found in the public interest, or the legislature needs to make that amendment either way after a public interest review. Under this language, a hospital could temporarily increase their beds above their licensed capacity without going through a public interest review or needing an explicit exception to the hospital moratorium law. So if they need to add beds to decrease emergency department wait times, which is something that we've seen, we want them to be able to do that more quickly without having to go through that fairly lengthy review and approval process. And again, as you'll note in the language, this is about temporary changes, not about building a new wing or unit or a new hospital. For nursing homes, the proposal would allow those with licensed beds that are in layaway status, which is essentially, my term for it is cold storage. It's you have the beds, but you're not using them right now. You've set them aside and don't have to pay the fee on them while they are not in use. Under current law, there's a 60-day notice requirement before beds are pulled out of layaway and put in active status. Under this language, a nursing home would be able to pull beds out of layaway without having to wait for the 60-day statutory notice requirement and without having to pay the per-bed licensing fee that's associated with that action. It would also allow nursing homes to temporarily increase their bed capacity with non-layaway beds. There's a similar moratorium process that is in place in statute for nursing homes for non-layaway beds as well. Finally, for nursing homes, it temporarily waives notification timeframes for transfer and discharge of residents. These are statutorily required timeframes. They are contained in the Healthcare Bill of Rights. But under this waiver, nursing homes would have some flexibility to move residents when needed if they wanted to cohort in one location. Maybe it's a sister organization within a larger corporate structure or something like that, or if they need to move residents or discharge residents in response to a COVID surge. Finally, on the funeral home side, the bill would temporarily modify requirements for how long funeral homes, crematories, and alkaline hydrolysis facilities can hold decedents pending final disposition, and modify requirements related to standards for unlicensed personnel who assist morticians. So under current law for the funeral industry, there is a maximum number of days that a licensed mortician, funeral establishment, or alkaline hydrolysis facility can hold a decedent before final disposition must occur, and that limit is 6 days. That has typically been long enough. That has not been a problem. But what we did see during COVID, in particular during surges when families were delaying funerals because of travel challenges or gathering restrictions, there were times when that restriction to 6 days posed challenges for the industry. And this would give us the ability to waive that if a facility needs that. On the unlicensed staff piece, it's really about helping out with some workforce constraints in the funeral industry, allowing unlicensed staff to be able to assist with, moving, making removals of a decedent from the place of death, helping with funeral arrangements, helping with other work that is associated with the disposition of a body. As just a way to increase staffing capabilities within the industry during times when they are under pressure related to a COVID surge. So I will pause there and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rydrick. I do see Representative Munson has his hand up. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I have a couple of questions and I just wanted to clarify. I know that going through the COVID crisis and dealing with the governor's use of Chapter 12 to make a lot of changes ruffled feathers on our side of the aisle. And I do look to Chapter 144 as a solution to solving a lot of these changes. And I'm happy to see that this bill references that chapter of law. Many things in Chapter 144 that authorize the Commissioner of Health to make changes requires the Commissioner of Health to go to a court to seek permission to make changes. Is what you're talking about in authorizing is everything done outside of, just by unilaterally by her executive decision, or does anything allow businesses or hospitals that are impacted by these decisions to make their case before these changes are put into effect?
Ms. Rydrick?
Madam Chair and Representative Munson, the way the process has worked is that a hospital or a nursing home or a funeral home will come to us and request a waiver of a specific requirement. So, for example, a hospital has observation beds that they want to convert to a patient care unit during a surge, but they can't do that under the moratorium. So what this would do is allow us for that facility to waive that capacity limit for them. So we've been doing it case by case as each individual facility applies for a waiver. And the waivers under this bill are not waiving any requirements that might involve going for a court action or anything like that, but just things that are currently within the commissioner's ability or authority to waive. Or sorry, that would be in the commissioner's ability or authority to waive and not waiving someone else's authority.
Okay, Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. Sure. Thank you. And I guess more of a concern of mine is not the hospital or the business that's petitioning for the change or the loosening of the restrictions, but the other side of that, the business that would be impacted or lose business, or we see this all the time with hospitals asking for permission for expanding beds. We see the other hospital arguing they shouldn't have it. So is there some kind of discourse between those two businesses that would be impacted, or is it just one entity asking for change and the commissioner granting it? And I think that might be the answer.
Ms. Rydrick?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Munson, thank you for that clarification. It's a great question. And that does happen, especially on the hospital side with moratorium exceptions. I think it's important to note that, and it's why I've taken pains to say in my testimony that this is about temporary actions just in response to a surge in demand. We would not want to use a process like this to grant a hospital or a nursing home the ability to make a change for the long term that's going to have significant competitive impacts. The hospital moratorium law for all of its interesting aspects is something that remains in effect, and we really want this to be focused just on short-term surge needs and not on the long-term business plans of an organization.
Okay, and Madam Chair, just one more quick question.
Representative Munson.
Clarification. We talk about temporary changes. Is this bill making permanent changes to law so that we can make temporary changes for future pandemics, or is this really being limited only until June of 2022 or something temporary? I mean, are we solving this problem for future pandemics, or are we just touching on something that's just for this year?
Ms. Roderick?
Madam Chair and Representative, this really does make changes just through June 30th. It gives us ability to grant waivers through that would run through that time period. If the legislature wants to have that authority made permanent so that we could have that kind of flexibility in the case of future pandemics, they would need to take a separate action to do that.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Representative Munson. And just to say too, that the very purpose of doing a bill and bringing it through committees and posting it for the public is to get people's eyes on it so that if they see some potential problem, such as I think what you're very, you know, very wisely kind of thinking about, that they can speak up and let us know. So that is, we are giving a certain grant of authority to the commissioner here. Yes. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that introduction, because that's kind of the point on that I wanted to make. The amendment that is being proposed, the public did catch on some with that, and the folks in the mortuary sciences, the funeral directors, reached out to me with concerns with lines 2.1 to 2.3, just basically stating that they didn't really need it. And I was wondering if the department could comment on that. I understand that the Senate reviewed this and pulled out some of that language yesterday. And just wondering if the department could offer some notes on that so we can make according adjustments for ways and means.
Ms. Roderick?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Schumacher, you are correct. The other body did pull that language out today in the HHS Finance and Policy Committee, and we were comfortable with that change. As the chair noted, as we're learning more about this and talking more about this, we are hearing from some stakeholders that waivers that had been necessary are less so now, and they do not feel the language needs to be changed. So the other body did make that change, and we were comfortable with that.
Okay, thank you for that, and thank you, Madam Chair. I will be working with you and Representative Schultz to make sure that that gets done in the best public interest. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Representative Schumacher. So are there other questions for Ms. Roderick? Okay, I'm not seeing any. So with that, I'm going to then describe the next part of the amendment, which is the temporary practice by healthcare professionals from other states and territories. So as we know, we've actually, thank goodness, we seem to be coming out of the big Omicron surge, but we know, and we've had some hearings in this committee, how devastating this has been in our hospitals, that they have been overrun with patients, and it's been a very stressful and difficult time. And a lot of this, of course, this same thing is happening nationwide, in fact, worldwide, that because of the pandemic, that hospital facilities and healthcare providers generally have been under an enormous amount of stress. So there has been some requests to try to bring in other healthcare providers from outside of the state who might not be licensed here. And of course, we've also seen, we had a presentation yesterday on a lot of the things that the administration has done to alleviate the pressure. And apparently a lot of that has been very, very helpful. But so this is our attempt to figure out what the barriers were to, you know, why we've been having calls to speed up the process for licensing. Some people seem to feel that that there are barriers to people coming here, and but no one's actually been able to figure out in the short term what those barriers really are. So what this language does is it goes back to the governor's original executive order, and it builds off of that. And what the governor had done in that early executive order, early in the pandemic, was just create a waiver that allowed for a temporary period of time, allowed licensed professionals from other states, licensed either under the Board of Medical Practice or under the Board of Nursing, to come into Minnesota if they had a similar credential that was in good standing in another state, to come in, practice, and give aid in Minnesota. And that seemed to work reasonably well. It wasn't perfect, but it was a good emergency measure at the time from reports. So this really builds on that. It does something very similar to that. It just says for 60 days that we would pretty much waive the Minnesota licensing process and simply allow employers to make the determination that the person they want to hire, either through an agency or directly, has a similar license in another state that's in good standing, and then hire that person and allow them to practice for up to 60 days. And all it really requires from the employer is that they then make a report to the Department of Health about basically who they've hired. And you can read the detail in the language there. And then we have just to be transparent with everyone, we've heard from the Board of Nursing and the Board of Medical Practice, and they're not thrilled with this language because they feel that, there are some problems here for them about whether they would really be able to police any misconduct and so on. And so we will, understanding this is not going to the floor, this is going to ways, and we will continue to work on this. I'm frankly not sure if the Senate is interested in doing anything with this language. We'll see. So so that's kind of the state of things for this. And so it's just a 60-day waiver of Minnesota's licensing for anyone who's under either of these two boards. So I will be happy to take questions on that. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had a similar thought during one of the special sessions. Many of our larger medical organizations have facilities.
Representative Quam, I've lost your audio. Sorry.
Part of the Nurses Compact. I like the idea of during emergency allowing, but since the majority of the states have joined in on something that verifies an agreed upon criteria for licensure, I think it might be good for it to, a general, not just for this pandemic, but if there's a outbreak, if there's another localized medical issue, some quarantine, et cetera, and a facility needs to bring in staff, do we have that type of emergency capability? And 2 years from now, there might be, something. And so I'd like us to look at a longer term emergency, short term allowability, but with the verification that, which most of the states have done for the Nurses Compact for a minimum. And I think there's some similar language with some sufficient, or there's a compact for some of the specialties for physicians. And then something that takes into account that if the entity has locations in the state of Minnesota, that they would be able to temporarily bring people from one of their facilities from another state. I know that. Yeah, this would be something we'd have to work on together, or that would be evolving as this bill moves along. But I just think we might as well be smart in the long term by looking at what would have helped in the short term. And that's just a thought, and I'm willing to assist in maybe an amendment in the future.
So let me just be clear, members, we're not taking up the nurse licensure compact. This committee actually voted down that bill in the past, and we're not taking that up. And if, you know, if this is, as I have said a couple of times to others, you know, we can't let the best, if you consider that the best, which I don't, but if that's your best, don't let the best be the enemy of the good. So if, you know, this is supposed to be a temporary measure, just like all of the other issues, the other things on this bill that are temporary waivers, and they're meant to deal with the short term. Now, I think it's probably wise to realize that COVID is not going away, and we probably will have further waves. And if it isn't COVID, it'll be something else. And I think it would be smart of us to think about that. But this bill is not the vehicle for that. And if anyone wants to, if we think we need a temporary waiver, any temporary waivers, then, you know, this is the bill. We're not going to, these are complex issues. And if we want to move something quickly, which is the intention here, then this is what we've got, or something mighty close to it. So I'm going to go to Representative Quinn.
Madam Chair, just a clarification. I was using the Nurses Compact as an example. I think we should have some sort of base criteria. And we don't have to mention the Nurses Compact. We could mention
okay, Representative Quinn, thank you. Thank you for that. I'm just saying we're not going to write a whole new bill here on this bill. We just don't really have the time for that. We're at the beginning of a session. There's plenty of time to do things that are long-term, but this is not the vehicle for it. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So you actually just touched on the questions and the one thing that I sort of felt was missing in this language, and this is this had to do with the sort of this conflict between the nurses who are coming in and the Board of Nursing. And so what I noticed in the language is that the healthcare employer for these out-of-state healthcare professionals under this section must submit a report to the Commissioner of Health. So what I don't see in here are two things. One is that I don't see that an out-of-health professional, and I'm speaking nursing because I'm a nurse, but it would apply to providers also. Is there a process, and I don't see a process for these nurses when they come in to connect with the Board of Nursing, you know, to submit their personal or their professional information. So I don't see any language for that in here. And then I also don't see at some point, and possibly this would be that gap between the Board of Nursing and these out-of-state health professionals, you know, to submit reports to the Board of Nursing, not just to the Commissioner of Health, regarding the activity that's going on between the out-of-state nurses and these two boards. So that was just a comment as we're moving forward and trying to get the language right. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ackland. I appreciate that. And as I say, we will be working on this. And the idea is to make it as smooth and non-bureaucratic as possible while still providing the protection that Minnesota patients deserve. And so we're trying to strike that balance. Thank you. Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the comments that you made as you were introducing this particular amendment about the shortage of staffing and the pressure that's being felt by those within the healthcare field. And I know I've heard from a number of constituents that exact thing, that it's not a lack of bed license, it's a lack of staffing and the pressure that they're feeling and the long hours. Just one clarification on that. With the 60-day, my understanding is current law, we have a 60-day grace period for that licensing. So with this, the 60 days that are in here, are we just matching current law, or is this going to actually solve part of the problem? And can you just address that a little bit?
Well, yeah, this is probably where I need to connect more with the boards to understand how this would interact. But we have some 60-day, provisional license. I can't remember exactly what the language is, what they're called, language by endorsement or license by endorsement or something. but I don't think it applies to everyone. You know, one thing that's not usually remembered when we're talking about this issue is that the nurses who are in the states licensed in our border states already have the ability to come and practice in Minnesota with a sort of abbreviated process. So, you know, no one should think we need this to get nurses from Wisconsin, for example, to come into Minnesota. And I think you're so absolutely right that the problem is that there's a shortage, and that's why we've heard a lot of presentations recently about the workforce shortage, and this is going to be just a huge topic. How do we deal with it in the short term, and how are we going to deal with it in the longer term? Because it's not getting any easier. And the reality is we don't have other professionals just sitting outside our borders waiting to come in. But so the answer to your question, I guess, is I'm not really sure what the total interaction of that would be. And that'll be part of my discussion with the boards. And this is just really an attempt to do some short-term relief, if it even helps. Because, you know, there's little reason to believe, like I said, that there are lots of professionals that are just waiting to come here because they're busy in other places. You know, it's not as though Minnesota was the only state with the problem. So, you know, it's just a much larger discussion that we need to have. But this is just an attempt to do a 60-day, you know, relief of pressure kind of thing. And, you know, hopefully the need has gone down a little bit already, but we hope we won't have a bigger need during those 60 days. Does that help, Representative Damon?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? All right, seeing none, so I'm going to renew my motion that we adopt the A2-1 amendment. So all in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. So any further comments to or discussion to the bill as amended? And I really do appreciate your comments, members, and your input on this. And as I told Representative Schumacher, this is really intended to be as much as possible, a consensus bill that just helps us deal with the urgent issues before us, and hopefully one that we can move through pretty quickly. So any further discussion? All right, if there is no further discussion, then Representative Schultz renews her motion that House File 2914, the first engrossment as amended, be re-referred to Ways and Means. And because we're in the virtual environment, we need to take a roll call on that. So Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would call the roll.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damoth.
Damoth, aye.
Damoth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Freiberg, aye.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor. Representative Pryor. Representative Quam. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. 16 ayes and one nay.
Right, there being 16 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails and the bill is passed to Ways and Means. Thank you, members. Okay, we will move on now. We have Commissioner Malcolm here to talk with us about the governor's supplemental budget in the health area. So welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Good afternoon and good afternoon, members. It's good to be with you. I want to just begin, Madam Chair, by thanking you and the committee for really great support that you've provided to our agency, to MDH, during the last very difficult 2 years. And I know that same is true for your support of your local public health agencies around the state. Your support has helped us to move quickly in many instances to provide support to providers, to stand up testing and vaccination. And we and all Minnesotans should be really grateful for that. I'm really very excited to present this supplemental budget to you today. It is large by comparison to what you would typically see in a supplemental budget, and large coming from MDH. But I think that represents the extraordinary opportunity that we have with a healthy surplus to do some really smart things to help respond to issues that have been clarified and exacerbated during the pandemic, as well as to make investments in prevention of future problems. So the first slide just is a quick overview of the entirety of this recommendation. The governor has 29 different budget proposals for MDH in this bill, totaling $233 million in the current biennium and $731 million in the next biennium. The majority of the proposals are general fund proposals, but there are also a few recommendations funded with healthcare access funds, revenues from dedicated accounts, and fee revenues in the state government special revenue fund. So I'm going to go really quickly. We've kind of grouped these 29 proposals into some categories that sort of have a common theme. I have very high-level brief explanations. We do have other staff on the meeting today if there are time for more detailed questions. And of course, you will be having many more discussions about these proposals as we go. So the first category is addressing healthcare access and affordability. And I think one of the features of the governor's budget, and I'm sure you've heard this from DHS as well, is the interagency nature of a number of these things and the relationship that these categories have with the governor's One Minnesota plan. And that is certainly true of this first category around addressing healthcare access and affordability. I'm gonna go through each one of these proposals quite briefly. So the next slide talks about addressing growing healthcare costs in specific. We haven't talked as much about cost and how we have a sustainable healthcare system from the perspective not only of state budgets, but employer budgets and family budgets. So this is a proposal from MDH, is four interconnected initiatives aimed at getting a clearer understanding of what's driving the growth in costs and what might be some solutions to that, while paying particular attention to our rural healthcare systems, which have had some particular challenges, especially economically during this pandemic. The first initiative establishes a system of spending targets, like a goal. This is not, and this is voluntary. This is nothing that has a regulatory scheme to it, at least not in the near future, if ever. But this would be a system of targets that really creates some motivation for us as a state and for payers and providers to see how we're doing against what would seem to be a reasonable expectation for spending. The second identifies strategies to reduce the cost drivers, specifically in administrative spending, and what we term as low value care, where the evidence is pretty clear that the care is not really resulting in greater health gain. The third initiative extends prescription drug transparency transparency to more entities in that supply chain to more fully capture the cost drivers of pharmaceuticals. And finally, it explores opportunities to adopt advanced payment systems in rural areas specifically to financially stabilize them. We know that the business model of many hospitals reliant on fee-for-service revenues from higher reimbursing procedures has been extremely disrupted by the COVID pandemic and has helped us to understand that we may not have the optimal financing system to assure kind of core availability, core access to needed services. The next slide talks about addressing healthcare access and affordability through a healthcare provider directory, which may not sound like a big deal, but this would actually be really significant for consumers, providers, and state government, as well as payers. What this would do is develop a statewide shared healthcare provider directory, would maintain a single centralized database of all health providers in the state and the health plan networks they're in. So that would give consumers, as well as plans, providers themselves, and state agencies a single place to go to get accurate and up-to-date information about what providers are available through which insurance plans. And keeping that easy and up-to-date will be a powerful tool, we think, for consumers, but it'll also improve some administrative efficiencies for government programs and health plans and provider organizations with interface with these different types of insurance. The next one here is funding to give the authority and resources to the state, MDH in this case, to enforce the federal No Surprises Act, which has really pretty broad consumer protections against most medical bills that come as a surprise for someone who thinks they're getting in-network care or expects something to be covered only to get a potentially very large bill from a provider somehow involved in that episode of care. This would enhance price transparency and prescribe a dispute resolution process between health plans and providers and for a process between providers and consumers, and a few other provisions to protect insured as well as from surprise billing. This would, in addition to just enforcement of this act, support development of a state level process for Minnesotans to register and resolve complaints for surprise billing issues, inform them of their rights, and reviewing health plans for compliance with this law. Moving on to the next slide, also related to healthcare access and affordability, a proposal around revitalizing the healthcare workforce, directly following on your committee discussion yesterday. This is specifically about the rural healthcare workforce and also the workforce in other underserved service lines and geographies. Each one of these items addresses issues along the training and practice continuum of the workforce pipeline. Major components here are developing rural training track grants for family medicine physicians and investing in rural in-clinical training for nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and dental providers. It also increases funding for international immigrant medical training, which would allow us to better leverage the existing professional talent that exists among our immigrant communities with providers who have experience, but not experience in Minnesota healthcare requirements to enable them to get through that training, to extend our ability to provide culturally competent care to many underserved communities. This also expands site-based clinical training for sites that don't otherwise qualify for the current forms of medical education funding in the state. So getting at some of those providers that are serving harder to reach populations. For example, it provides funding for mental health occupations training, specifically to cover supervision costs associated with licensure to make it easier for more provider organizations to serve as training sites and supervisors for mental health occupations. And finally, it funds some additional research on the healthcare worker pipeline, understanding some of the challenges there and some of the barriers why people aren't going into these fields as much as we need them to allow us to inform data-driven longer-term solutions. So that was the first kind of bucket of healthcare access and affordability. The next set of proposals, 10 of them in this category, implement quite a variety of public health prevention strategies. And this is, again, why I'm so grateful for the governor's support of a number of things to try to work further upstream to prevent problems from occurring rather than missing that opportunity and then dealing with the consequences of the cost of intervention further down the road after something has happened. So in this category, the first two on this slide that you're looking at are the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is moving from its current state, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which provides mental health crisis support to Minnesotans 24/7. That's going to be replaced, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, with a new three-digit number, 988. That's going to start in July 2022, this year. So the current system is going to be replaced by this 988, which the virtue of that will be a lot easier, quicker number for people to remember and to get to. So it's very much expected to meet the needs of more people, and that would be a very good thing. Every state is expected to be able to implement this by July of 22 and to support all 988 contacts locally and to augment the 988 phone number by expanding services to include chats and texts in addition to phone calls so that even more Minnesotans could be reached. It's heartbreaking to tell you that in 2021, over 39,000 Minnesotans reached out for help through the existing National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And we think that, frankly, more Minnesotans than that will reach out to this through this new 988 number due to its improved accessibility through a simple three-digit number or chats or texts. And strengthening 988 services will help us prevent suicide, which is the eighth leading cause of death in Minnesota. I don't know that that is commonly known to most folks how very significant an issue this is in our state and nationally. And certainly preventing suicide is the kind of the key at the heart, also is a pathway to support better mental well-being for Minnesotans in general. This next initiative around drug overdose and substance use prevention it also responds to something that has been growing significantly and undoubtedly exacerbated by the pandemic. Drug overdose deaths increased 33% from 2019 to 2020. And while it takes a while for the data to come in on 2021, it's pretty clear that 2021 is going to set another record. For each one of these preventable deaths, so for every fatality, there were 14 non-fatal overdoses treated in the hospital. This is the most recent data from 2020. So the impacts of the overdose epidemic have affected so many people. Hard to even calculate between struggling with these issues to their families, loved ones, their communities, their employers. This is something that truly is a statewide impact, and turning the tide in this really also requires a comprehensive approach that really touches many factors. So here we're proposing three strategies that take a comprehensive approach. One is to develop regional multidisciplinary overdose prevention teams made up of public health, public safety, behavioral health, education, healthcare providers, and others working on these issues to work at the community level to take a multifaceted approach to understanding these phenomena and to prevent substance misuse and overdose. A second component is to enhance housing and support services for homeless people who are at heightened risk of overdose. And finally, to equip business owners with resources to foster a supportive environment for employees in recovery and to encourage their success. On the next page, also related to overdose prevention, specifically for persons experiencing homelessness, particularly targeting opioid overdose and HIV prevention. Currently, the Department of Health is responding to ongoing HIV outbreaks in Duluth and in Hennepin and Ramsey counties. These outbreaks are predominantly impacting people who inject drugs and people who are experiencing homelessness. And we know that in the decade from 2007 to 2017, there was a 300% increase in injection drug use in Minnesota. And as we just talked about, from 2019 to 2020, there was a 33% increase in fatal drug overdoses. We know that homelessness is a significant barrier for access to both substance abuse treatment and also barrier to access for medical treatment for the conditions that we're talking about here. Persons with untreated HIV have much higher viral loads than persons who are receiving appropriate medical treatment, risks their own health and for transmission. Needle sharing is more common among homeless populations, which makes people experiencing homelessness more susceptible and vulnerable to acquiring infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. So this request expands syringe services program that reduce the harm associated with drug use for people experiencing homelessness and housing instability. This will expand services for syringe exchange. This is both access to clean syringes and disposal of used syringes, which helps to get these dangerous products off the street, helps with overdose prevention, HIV and hepatitis testing and connection for people to appropriate medical treatment for HIV and hep C, but also referrals to treatment for substance use disorders. This proposal is part of a larger package of requests from the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness, the package requesting a number of investments related to housing instability and homelessness.
Commissioner, I see a hand up, and I failed to ask you if you wanted to be interrupted or would like to finish the presentation before we take questions.
At your pleasure, Madam Chair. I think there's a lot to get through here, and I thought it might be beneficial to the committee to see everything in brief and then come back to questions if that is okay with you.
Okay. Representative Ryer, does that work for you? Okay, she says yes. So go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you. The next item here in the prevention category is sentinel event reviews for police-involved deadly force encounters. When someone dies during an encounter with law enforcement, the impact is devastating and on multiple levels, certainly for families, for neighborhoods, for entire communities, for the entire state. And we know that these tragedies have certainly had a disproportionate impact, both in terms of frequency, severity, and trauma caused on Minnesotans of color, especially Black and Indigenous Minnesotans. Approaching this issue as a public health problem really lets us look at changes in policy and practice that can be made upstream at a whole systems level to try to prevent this from happening, to prevent future deaths before interaction or during interaction with law enforcement. And we in public health have been using sentinel event reviews for quite a long time, decades literally, to identify patterns in some of our toughest topics and make actionable recommendations for prevention. We've used sentinel event reviews for drug overdose, infant mortality, suicide among veterans, and it's just proven to be very, very useful. The next slide in the prevention category first is a significant expansion of community health workers. These folks are trusted resources in the communities they come from. They share life experiences, cultural and linguistic backgrounds with their clients, which makes their clients much more likely to seek them out as resources, and they help those clients to seek preventive care rather than visiting the emergency department, or to manage their chronic health conditions and to change behaviors to better support their health. And community health workers are also really working at that intersection between the clinical part of improving health and addressing the conditions far further upstream, the so-called social determinants of health around living and working conditions, educational success, and the like, that are often the real root cause of so many poor health outcomes and a lot of healthcare spending. The return on investment for community health worker services in past studies has ranged anywhere from $3 return in benefits for every dollar spent to more than 15-1 in these past studies. And we think this was likely an even greater impact during the height of COVID-19 in Minnesota. And we strongly believe that strengthening the community health worker workforce will be a powerful strategy to help reduce health disparities and healthcare spending in Minnesota. What this will do is increase the hiring of community health workers, not only in traditional settings like medical clinics, but settings they haven't previously worked in, like public safety, factories, and schools, expanding the reach of community health workers to better address current health conditions in other settings, and to address the cultural specificity of the communities they serve. That would further help us to expand data collection and analysis to understand the impact of community health workers and to improve that infrastructure for the long-term in Minnesota. These are often grant-funded positions without necessarily a sustainable financing model. The next issue, and I realize there's a lot of variety here, it kind of illustrates the breadth of prevention opportunities that we have. This next one is really recognizing disability. We, of course, know that people with disabilities face many barriers to living healthy lives, and that nearly 2 out of 3 people with disabilities have a chronic condition, a much higher proportion than people without a disability. And we know that many people with disabilities cannot find a healthcare provider that can meet their needs. They literally lack the right kind of equipment or the right clinical expertise to be able to deal with people with disability. Or those persons may not have adequate health insurance. And as a result, we do see significant disparities in health status and higher health costs over time for persons with disabilities. In fact, direct healthcare spending on persons with disabilities in Minnesota accounts for up to 34% of the state's healthcare spending, plus about 21,260, about, the latest data is $21,267 per year per person with a disability. And currently, we at MDH, while we work with persons with disabilities in many of our programs, and we have learned so much about the ways in which persons with disabilities aren't being fully supported through the COVID pandemic, we don't have a dedicated program to support people with disabilities at MDH, and we think it's overdue that we should have one. This funding would allow us better coordinate our supports for persons with disabilities across many programs, but it would also allow us to convene the stakeholders and continue to dialogue and work with them to identify and address barriers, as well as collecting data that we need to have to identify and address health gaps and to distribute and administer grants and support partners in improving the health disparity gaps that exist in this population. The lack of data is really a significant issue. For the most part, a lot of risk assessment methods don't even ask about disability status. So we know we've got some big data gaps to close there. The next two prevention proposals both have to do with lead. Lead remediation in schools and childcare settings is the first. We know now that there is no safe level of lead in drinking water, and that infants and children are most vulnerable to the toxic effects of lead on young brain development. Infants and children might drink a lot of water in these settings, and school buildings in particular are often older construction dating back before lead-free plumbing was required. And we know that many schools and childcare facilities are frankly reluctant to test for lead, and they say so because they don't have the funds to do anything about it. And remediation funds can help to overcome some of that resistance to finding out if there's a problem. We did we at MDH co-authored a report with the U of Minnesota in 2019, which helped us estimate that for every dollar spent addressing lead in drinking water, removing lead from drinking water, at least $2 in benefits are gained. The second proposal here is to do an inventory of all the lead service lines in the state. More than 90% of Minnesota's community water systems serve populations less than 3,300, and they have significant capacity challenges. Following the tragedy in Flint, Michigan, there's been so much more recognition of the importance of removing lead pipes connecting water mains to homes so that exposures to lead will be prevented. An accurate inventory of knowing where these lead pipe connections are is the first step to alerting residents and establishing a schedule for. And as well, targeting the new federal infrastructure funding to remove lead service lines most efficiently. The last two in this category, I believe, for prevention, there might be one more after this. The next one is mercury skin lightening grants. We know that mercury and other harmful chemicals can be often found in skin lightening creams, which adversely affect some of our communities in Minnesota. This proposal reinstates a grant program that we had. It was a one-time grant program that we had in 2019 that we would like to see reinstated. This not only helps MDH, but grantees educate communities about the dangers of mercury and allows MDH to track mercury poisoning through a required reporting system. Next, climate resiliency initiative. Again, this is a reestablishment of a program that was formerly funded at the federal level, but federal funding stopped in 2021. So this would reestablish the climate and health program at MDH so that we can support public health related climate activities across the administration. The governor, as you know, has a climate action framework, and this is another interagency priority to deal with climate change. And our part of that is to help understand and support local communities to facilitate planning and response actions as to the effect of climate change on health through technical assistance, data analysis, and evaluation. Here too, we have a particular focus on drinking water sources affected by changes in climate. And that is the prevention package, although the next bucket of initiatives on supporting families and children really all are prevention as well.
Commissioner?
Yes.
So maybe since it is now 4:12, so we have 18 minutes left in the hearing, we could certainly continue your proposal on another hearing date. We don't have to finish it all today.
Okay.
So I would like, I don't know if this is a good place for you to stop, but or pause, I should say. And we've got a couple of questions. I would like to give members a few minutes to ask questions about what they've heard. And you tell me if this is a good pause point.
I think it's a great idea, Madam Chair. And this is a good, a logical break point, as logical as any. So happy to come back and finish this.
All right. Very good. Well, then let's take a couple of questions from members. So Representative Ryer's been waiting, and then Freiberg. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for Commissioner. I will take this opportunity to thank you and the team for all you've done for the state these last couple of years. My first question, and I'm only going to ask one, but my first question came up around the issue related to enhanced housing and supportive services for homeless people who are at risk of overdose on the drug overdose and substance abuse question. And because I'm on both the housing and the preventing homelessness committees, I spend a lot of time thinking about that. Then later you mentioned interagency cooperation and what your part of a certain initiative was for health. So I'm wondering what your part for health, what does that look like just a bit more specifically? Because it would help me as I think about the puzzle pieces. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Ryan, first, thank you for the kind words there for all of our colleagues in public health. In terms of the housing and supportive services, we're part of the Interagency Council on Homelessness, and there are two initiatives, as you heard. There's particular infectious disease risk among persons experiencing homelessness. We've certainly seen it with the COVID pandemic, but with these other conditions as well. So we are, you know, our role here is to try to help homeless and supportive services providers to understand and mitigate health risks in their setting. I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Mary Manning is on the line and could maybe add a little more detail here. If Mary, if you're on, would you mind chiming in? And if she's
welcome if she's to the on. Committee.
Oh, she's
and you are muted, but please unmute and introduce yourself.
Chair.
Yes.
Committee. What our role is really looking more at the health issues that the person might have and linking them to the services and evaluating those types of things that they might have. Kind of like when the commissioner talked about the community health worker who would kind of be doing the evaluation of and helping them assess their needs and, you know, broader than just the health needs, but other community-based services that they might know and need to be linked in with. And really helping with their immediate health needs and then maybe some longer term, even if it needs to be referral to substance abuse or other things. Some of that is done by DHS, but some of the health issues more so run closer with the Department of Health. Does that answer your question?
Representative Breyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Manning. Yes, so I hear it as being a layer of wraparound services that are directly related to health. Is that accurate? Okay,
yes.
Thank you very much. Manning. I appreciate
All
that.
All right. Okay, thank you. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here, Commissioner Malcolm. Really pleased to see the strong focus on prevention in the governor's budget. And a couple of the issues specifically we've already talked about so far this year in the Preventive Health Policy Division. I was just looking at your slides. I'm pleased to see the provision related to climate resiliency in there, as well as the lead remediation provisions in there. Certainly, I do think a critical part of addressing the whole issue of lead is having an inventory so you know where there are issues with lead pipes. We heard a bill related to allowing for the creation of a program to help residents who have lead service lines replace those lines, creating a grant program to help them to do so, because obviously replacing service lines can be a pretty expensive endeavor. I guess I'm just wondering if there are efforts in here or if you know there will be some in the future to actually help residents with the cost of lead service line replacement.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Freiberg, yes, I've made just a really brief reference to the federal infrastructure funds. We just actually had a multiple commissioner call with the head of the EPA just last week talking about kind of what Minnesota is looking for out of those federal infrastructure funds. But certainly, the inventory, as you suggest, tells us where the need is, but we know we need remediation dollars. How much of that can be met through the infrastructure bill and how much of that will need to be future state strategies, we'll certainly have a better handle on in the next year or so as those infrastructure funds roll out.
Representative Freiberg?
Okay. Thank you.
Great. All right. Thank you so much. So before we move on, since we have a little bit of a pause here, I just want to go back kind of rewind us back to before the commissioner started speaking. We had our vote on House File 2914, and Representative Quam had a computer audio glitch and was trying to vote and was unable to get his vote recorded. So there's no really perfect way to do this, but we'd like to be able to record his vote. So Representative Quam, if you would just let us know how you wanted to vote, and then we will, with everyone's indulgence, we will just record him as having voted, because he was indeed trying. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did vote aye, but you know how soft-spoken I am.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Quam. I know I have to turn up the volume every time you speak. So we will record your aye vote. Thank you very much. Okay, well, Commissioner, we have 10 more minutes. I don't know if you would want to, if you feel you can use the time, and please go ahead it's not that important, but I think Ms. Manning, if you would take a moment to just state your name for the record and your title. I don't think we captured that, if you wouldn't mind.
I'm sorry. Mary Manning, Assistant Commissioner, Health Improvement Bureau.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ms. Manning. Sorry about that. Okay. All right, Commissioner, please continue.
Happy to. This next category is supporting families and children. Again, part of a package developed by a number of agencies working together on this priority area under the governor's One Minnesota plan. So the first initiative here is a new grant program called Community Healing. And this is specifically about COVID-19 recovery to fund community identified solutions to address particularly the mental well-being impacts of COVID-19. This would be collaboration with community-based service organizations, faith-based organizations, local public health departments, many of those partners that have been helping us to get testing and vaccination resources deeper into the communities to now work on recovery. But again, the key here being community-identified solutions, not a pre-identified set of initiatives from us, but supporting community-identified solutions. This next one is about long COVID. We absolutely know that we must better understand long COVID. We believe the research is beginning to show that long COVID is likely to affect anywhere between 10% and 35% of all people who've had any level of severity, including very mild or even asymptomatic cases, including children. So that's over 400,000 Minnesotans and growing that we expect will have some long-term consequences of COVID infections. And the frustrating thing for these folks is how debilitating, unpredictable it is, the disruptions in work, school, family life, physical and mental health, their potential to thrive, and they don't know how long it's going to last or what can be done about it, because long COVID is such a mix of conditions. There's not one set of presenting conditions that categorizes something as long COVID. So much work is needed here to better serve the folks who have been disproportionately impacted by COVID infections and will be disproportionately impacted by long COVID. And where we know that there's been greater impact in rural areas, low-income areas, and Minnesotans of color, American Indians, people with disabilities, as mentioned before, the LGBTQ community, and the intersection of those multiple issues. So this would enable us to not only do some work at the Minnesota level and contribute to work at the national level, but also to work on guidance for healthcare providers and resources for survivors, caregivers, and the settings in which they are found. We really feel like we need to get going on this urgently now. We know that there's federal work going to be happening here too, but to understand how many Minnesotans are already being impacted by long COVID, where they live and work, the length and severity of their illness, and how best we and healthcare providers can support them in the coming years. The next part of this family and children package is Community Solutions, which is a grant program that has existed since June of 2020. And it's all about promoting, improving healthy development from children from prenatal to grade three, and how stable and nurturing relationships in the home, in the school, in the community can serve that goal. Since initiation, the program has really significantly empowered parents and caregivers and community leaders to support children's development and has increased culturally congruent services, provided a safe space for families and caregivers, and reduced stigma and system bias. These grants go to community-led and community-based organizations serving children of underserved communities and communities at higher risk, from prenatal to third grade, to reduce racial disparities in children's health and development and to promote racial and geographic equity. So what this recommendation does is increase the size and the number of grants that we can give and extends the program past June 2023 when the existing funding is scheduled to run out. Again, this is also the power of this, the importance of this is its solutions coming from community groups themselves. The next part of this Children and Families package is a big expansion of home visiting. This is a voluntary service for pregnant women and child caregivers most in need of support that links pregnant women with quality prenatal care, supports parents early in their parenting role, and ensures that very young children develop in safe and healthy environments by imparting parenting skills and support that increase their ability to parent and decrease the risk of child abuse. At the present time, even with the expansions over the years that we have been able to do, we know we're only serving about 10% of eligible families who would benefit from home visiting services. And this funding would allow us to expand funding in three tiers of home visiting. The first would be a number of regional pilots of universal short-term home visiting, where every family could avail themselves of at least short-term home visiting resources. And second, long-term evidence-based home visiting programs across the state and evidence-informed home visiting programs to serve specific priority populations with disproportionate negative outcomes. Over 90% of these funds would go to community health boards, tribal nations, and nonprofits. The next one here is family planning special projects. Family planning clinics have been deeply impacted by COVID-19, and many of their patients have deferred critical preventive care. We know that family planning clinics are on the front lines for screening, testing, and treatment of sexually transmitted infections, and we know those are on the rise. 27% increase, for example, in reported gonorrhea cases in 2020. So these funds would increase statewide access to evidence-based voluntary family planning, counseling and education, contraception service, screening and treatment for Minnesotans who have difficulty accessing services. This will allow family planning grantees to lengthen their clinic hours, reduce patient wait times, provide more one-on-one counseling, maintain telehealth technology and security, and maintain and increase language translation services in order to meet all of this in order to meet the many needs of their clients' delayed services due to COVID-19. Just two more in this section, I believe. Next one called Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Families.
And Commissioner, we only have about two more minutes, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
I don't know if you wanna say something about this, but we won't be able to get through the whole slide, I don't think.
Yeah, I think it's fine to just stop here. Maybe we can pick it up and with this category and pick up members' questions when we come back.
Great, that's great. And I will for sure we'll be able to schedule you next week and we'll finish with your presentation. Okay, So thank you very much, members, for your attention today. Thank you very much, Commissioner and staff, for your presentation and all your hard work. Obviously, it doesn't come together easily with all these proposals take a great deal of work. So thank you for all of that. And if there is are no further comments or concerns expressed today, we stand adjourned.